Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 684 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is a Friday Spotlight episode. And Manny and I are going to be talking about three recent comics that hit stands and give our thoughts on Justice League number 15, which we'll probably do a little more in-depth, probably do an issue synopsis, and then we'll talk a little briefly about Captain Marvel number one and also Wrong Earth number one from Ahoy Comics, which is a new publisher. So again, they're all relatively recent books, and we kind of chose them. I mean, we've been covering Justice League pretty steadily on the podcast, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback. And I thought about, I didn't know how long we were going to cover Justice League and do these Justice League spotlights when we kicked it off, but everybody is clamoring for them. Everyone's asking for them. So we're going to be continuing the Justice League spotlights for the foreseeable future. Obviously, with Captain Marvel about to hit theaters, the movie's just a couple weeks away now. Marvel has launched a new Captain Marvel series from Kelly Thompson, so we want to discuss that. And I've heard a lot of good things about this Wrong Earth series. And in fact, I went to the Ahoy Comics panel when I was at New York Comic Con last year, and the panel was pretty well attended for being a publisher that is basically brand new. Clearly talented creators who have been around the block, like Jamal Igel and Tom Pyre, but they're trying something different. A lot of back matter. I think all their comics are like 40 pages, and you know, it's the normal 25, 24 page comic story, but then, as I said, other short stories, art, all kinds of extras in the back. And so we're going to talk a little bit about Wrong Earth number one, which was an intriguing start, but we'll get into that in a minute. First, I want to mention our sponsor for this episode. It's Aftershock Comics, the independent comics and graphic novel publisher, sending shockwaves throughout your local comic shop with groundbreaking series like A Walk Through Hell by Garth Ennis and Goran Suzuka, Animosity by Marguerite Bennett and Raphael Della Torre, Dark Arc by Cullen Bunn and Juan Doe, and new must-reads like Oberon from Ryan Parrott and Miloš Slavkovic, Stronghold from Phil Hester and Ryan Kelly, which we recently spotlighted on the show, and also coming soon, Out of the Blue, from legendary writer Garth Ennis and artist Keith Burns, who are reuniting after the success of their series Johnny Red. This is another tale, World War II, aerial combat, but it's going to be presented in high-quality hardcover format. And if any of you have seen any of the hardcovers that Aftershock has put out in the past, you'll know they really take their time. They show a lot of care and put out a really, really great product. So check out all that and more that's coming out from Aftershock by going to AftershockComics.com. And remember that this year their slogan is Read Dangerously. When you go to Aftershock.com, you can click on the drop-down menu, check out all their series. They have synopsis to let you know what they're about. They have diamond codes. There's even links to buy things digitally from Comixology. So we're big fans of Aftershock. We, you know, continue to support them. They give us great access to creator interviews and previews for their upcoming titles and all that kind of great stuff. So do yourself a favor, go check out AftershockComics.com. Their stuff is quality, and we've been fans right from the beginning, right, Manny?
Oh yeah, we. I think my first Aftershock book was Replica.
Still my favorite Aftershock title of all time. So, as we said, do yourself a favor and go check out AftershockComics.com. All right, let's dive into the issues for this episode. As I mentioned, we're going to start with Justice League number 15 from writers Scott Snyder and James Tynan. Tynan actually handles the scripting as well. Jim Chung and Steven Segovia on pencils. Mark Morales with Segovia on inks. We have Tomeu More and Will Quintana on colors. And letters are by Tom Napolitano. So this is the second part of the Escape from Hawkworld story. We saw a few issues back how the Martian Manhunter believed that he needed to get to Thanagar to speak with sort of the keeper of lore for the entire Martian race. There was this older Martian there who basically was the repository for all knowledge that Martians ever had. And based on the totality showing up on Earth and all these other forces manifesting themselves, John thought that this keeper of Martian knowledge might have some insight into what was going on. So he's been trying to get over there for a while. It's been hinted at. And we saw last issue 14, that he, John Stewart, and Hawkgirl, Kendra Sanders, finally got a chance to get over to Thanagar Prime. And things didn't exactly go the way they thought they would. All of a sudden, Shiera Hall, who was traditionally the Hawk Girl for years and years, or Hawk Woman, she seemed to be a little shady, like doing things a little underhanded. She was keeping secrets, and all of a sudden, secrets were popping up everywhere. Thanagar Prime was all about secrets, right? And they've always been somewhat secretive, a little xenophobic, but not to this extent, right? And their planet, their is basically a giant vault. So they're sort of the bankers of the universe, if you think about them like that, the Brinks of the DC universe, or what's the Harry Potter Gringotts? Is that what it's called? The bank in
Harry Potter? I don't remember,
with the little gnomes or elves or whatever they were that.
The bankers. I don't remember what they're called.
Yeah, I think it was Gringotts. Is what it's called. But anyway, that's kind of what the Thanagarians are, and. As the suspicion started to mount for Martian Manhunter and Hawkgirl and John Stewart, Green Lantern, all of a sudden, with their attempt to discover the truth, well, Shiera didn't like that. And we saw at the end, she summoned Hawkman, which is a different Hawkman that we've been seeing in the Hawkman series. This was the Savage Hawkman, Kator Hol, and he basically attacked the Justice Leaguers. So that was kind of the cliffhanger that issue 14 ended on. So issue 15 starts off, we're actually in the Hall of Justice, Washington, D.C., and we see that there's a bright light and some energy coming out of the Hall of Justice, and we see the Trinity there, and they're talking about how much energy is coming off of this person. It doesn't say exactly who it is. Wonder Woman mentions that the bystanders have all been evacuated from the Hall of Justice, and they need to contain this person at all costs. Meanwhile, Superman is saying that his cells are bathing in the energy that's coming off of this person. So this energy that's coming off of this person must be very similar to solar radiation. And Superman hints at the fact that he's basically absorbing so much radiation that he feels like he could crack the Earth in half if he took a step. And Batman, all he says is, well, don't. Right, don't crack the Earth in half by taking a step, Superman. And as we turn the page, we get this awesome full page panel here of Starman. That's who it is. That's who all this energy is coming off of. And we also saw last issue that Batman was trying to get some secrets of the totality and find out what knowledge Starman had. So Starman is saying that the universe is screaming. It needs to be healed. You must understand. So I'm guessing that this is coming from the source wall being broken and the fact that whatever is beyond the source wall is contaminating the universe now. And Starman is in some way connected to the universe and he feels the universe's pain. So as Starman starts to scream, Superman says his power is surging. We don't have any time. We need to take him down now. So as we turn the page, the scene shifts to Thanagar Prime, the other side of the universe. And as I mentioned, we see Carter Hall there with Kendra Sanders in hand about to, it looks like, knock her block off with his giant mace. And Shiera's in the background saying, you know, I'm not enjoying this. I don't relish any of the compromises I've had to make since I've become Empress of Thanagar Prime. I've done terrible things to protect this world's secrets. And I know you understand secrets, right? Your entire life, your history, it's all a secret that you yourself don't even understand. And you're out there looking for answers and you don't realize how dangerous that knowledge can be. But, you know, maybe in your next life you'll find it. And she implores Carter to go ahead and do it. And as Carter starts to bring the mace down, all of a sudden this person that they think is Kendra starts yelling, "Empress, Empress, hear me, I'm not the Earth hero." And Shiera realizes that she's been tricked. She says, "Martian Manhunter got in our damn minds." And so basically the Martian Manhunter got in the minds of Shiera and Carter Hall and made them believe that they had captured Hawk Girl, when really all they, the only thing they captured was another one of the Hawk guards. So Shiera orders everybody to go to the vault because that's where she believes the heroes will head to next. And then we get a clue as far as Savage Hawkman goes that things may not be exactly what we think they are or how they appear, because Shiera says, "My love will restore you fully soon enough. I won't let the Justice League destroy all we've built together." And he doesn't even say anything. I don't think he's said a word this entire time. It's almost like he's a zombie or something. And you kind of get that feeling when Shiera says, you know, "We'll restore you fully soon enough." So meanwhile, miles away, we see three Hawk guards land outside the vault. And it turns out that it's Martian Manhunter, John Stewart, Green Lantern, and Hawk Girl in disguise. And Martian Manhunter is saying that he has a plan. He learned a lot about the secrets of Thanagar when he was hiding out here earlier. Shiera complains about, Kendra rather, complains about how sick she is of all the secrets. And she's like, "You know, I held the totality in my hands. I took it away from Luther. I saved the universe. And I had its power flowing through my wings. And I still don't know anything. I still don't know what's going on. It's like secrets on top of secrets on top of secrets. And I just want answers. I hate it." And Martian Manhunter says, "Yeah, you know, it is strange that the Savage Hawkman had no mental shields, but I couldn't access his mind. Like, his mind wasn't there." So again, you start getting that idea. Was this guy like a zombie or something? So, and that's what Shiera meant when she said restored fully, because his body's been restored, but not his mind. And John Stewart even says, "Yeah, how did the illusion even work on him if he doesn't have a brain? He should have seen through it in a second." So Martian Manhunter is like, "Well, it doesn't really matter. We really need to get out of here. We need to find out what we're up against and get the knowledge we need and get out of here before we get captured." And John Stewart says, "You know, I don't mean to disrespect you, but I've heard horror stories about the vaults here, about people being trapped in them with no way to escape. And the vaults here cover the entire interior core of the planet. We're talking hundreds of millions of square miles. So is it really a good idea?" And I love what Kendra says. She goes, "So the space cop doesn't want to rob a bank. Big surprise." And John says, "You know, it's not just that. You know, this, we're violating their like sovereign power. And if the Green Lantern Corps has a treaty with them, that's going to make us look even worse. You know, we've got to have probable cause. We have to have a serious reason to do this." And Kendra's like, "They just tried to kill us?" And John says, well, yeah, but we're off-worlders and we're meddling in their internal politics. So legally, they have a right to kill us." And John Jones says, "Well, if what Kendra saw last night is true and the Martian Keep is being held against her will, then I think that gives us the right to meddle." And John says, John Stewart says, even if it isn't, I feel like we need to do what we need to do. And it's not like they can really take my ring away right now anyway, because we know that he has, doesn't have a real Green Lantern ring anymore. It's like tattooed on his skin, much like Hal Jordan was able to create a ring out of pure willpower. It seems like John Stewart has done something similar. So Kendra's all in, says, "You know, I've gotten out of tight places before. There's always a hole in the system." And Martian Manhunter mentions again, "Yeah, I'm living proof of that. I was able to live on this world where everybody is, you know, suspicious and there's, you know, cops everywhere. And they didn't detect me. And I have a decent understanding of the defense systems of this planet. And I think I have a plan." And then on the pages that follow, there's a ton of exposition as Martian Manhunter kind of lays out his plan. He gives us a rundown of the way the vaults work on Thanagar Prime, about how the interior of the planet is just vault after vault after vault, and about how tough it is to get vault space on Thanagar Prime. You have to petition the Thanagar governing body. You have to pay huge, huge amounts of cost. It takes years and years for the request to be processed. And then even after your request has been processed, if they accept you, then the Hawk Guard sends a contingent to your planet to look at whatever it is you want to store there to make sure it's worthy of the honor of being placed in the Great Nest, as they call these interior vaults. And then if the clients get approved, Thanagar actually transports them to Thanagar Prime in spaceships that don't have any windows so nobody can see what the stars are and map out where the location of Thanagar Prime is. So you have to jump through a lot of hoops. And as I said, it takes years and years and years. So on the following page, we see that we're outside the vault. We see tons of different alien races that are waiting to place their items in the vaults for the first time. And Martian Manhunter goes on to explain that every single person who goes into the vault is bioscanned to make sure that there's no shapeshifters or illusionists or thieves. And once they're actually allowed in the vault, they're implanted with these trackers. So the vault keepers can basically follow around any being that goes in their vault. They'll be able to track where their actual location is in real time. And if they stray off the path that they're approved of, because you're only approved to walk along certain paths and corridors and hallways that lead you in the most direct route to your storage area. And if you deviate from that, that little tracker implant that they put in you, yeah, it will explode and there goes your head. So, yeah, it's crazy, right? So we see some Dominators who have some kryptonite that they're looking to store. They say, yeah, it's a shard of the dead planet Krypton. We've been using it for metagene experimentation, and we're hoping we can replicate the solar absorption abilities of the Kryptonian race. And when the Vault Keepers scan it, they're like, we're picking up some strange radiation in this kryptonite. And the Dominators say, yeah, well, it's because the solar radiation of your binary star system is reacting with the kryptonite. And that's the whole reason we want to put it in the vault. We're hoping that this kryptonite will become even more powerful because of the binary system, the two stars that you guys have in your solar system. And so it will not only make this kryptonite more powerful, but it'll also make it worth a lot more than the 80 billion credits it's already worth. And so the Shiera, Carter Hall, and some other Hawk Guards show up, and the Dominion, the Dominators, they say, is there a problem? You know, they're wondering why these extra guards are showing up, these VIPs. And the other Dominator says, yeah, we applied for this position 7 years ago, and our masters will be displeased if we, you know, return without having made our deposit. And the Vault Keepers say, no, go ahead. It's fine. Somebody will bring you down shortly. And soon we see the Dominators descend to their particular spot in the vault while John Jones is giving us more information about the way the vault works. He's talking about how they have to descend for hours and hours to the heart of the planet to get to their one particular spot. And at this point, John's knowledge kind of runs out and he starts relying a little more on rumor and myth because he's never actually been this far inside the Thanagar vault. But he does know that there's tons of defenses between basically the exit of the vault and the core where the vault was assembled by the first great races of the universe. And John also says there's no way to know how many vaults exist within the core because the vault is actually made from crystals, which can grow as necessary if they need more space. So some say that the planet itself grows with every vault that's filled. And that could be a lie. It might be true. There's no way to know for sure. But what they do know is that there's only one route for each vault. And again, that's the route that you're assigned. And if you deviate off that route, then, you know, boom, there goes your head. So if the Vault Keepers suggest any foul play, the air is sucked out of all the vaults and anybody that's there freezes to death and pretty much immediately. And so lots of other secret defenses that they might not necessarily know about, but the rumors are there's ancient robotic guards, there's other horrors down there that live down in the vaults. And if you were to break in, you have, it's a formidable place. You have a lot of things that you have to contend with just to try to survive. So as the Dominators reach their vault and start to put the kryptonite in it, all of a sudden the kryptonite starts to change shape, and we realize that the reason they were picking up strange readings from the kryptonite is because it's not kryptonite at all. It's Martian Manhunter and John Stewart and Hawkgirl. John Stewart basically created some green kryptonite just through his willpower and his ring, and they hid inside it. So they immediately attack the Vault Keepers, and they're able to subdue him relatively quickly. And no sooner do they take out the Vault Keepers and the Dominators than John Jones starts communicating with the Martian Keep, and she tells him that he was foolish to return to that world and that he should leave. And Martian Manhunter is like, no, I really need to learn the truth from you, and that's why I came last time. And you know, you kind of chased me off, and that's not going to happen this time. I must know the truth. So as he starts to head and to look around for the Martian Keep, all of a sudden, Kendra, Carter Hall, and the other Hawk guards, the Royal guards, show up. And not only do they show up, but so does quite a few Green Lanterns. And they say that they're John Stewart, Hawkgirl, and Martian Manhunter are all under arrest. Because again, as John Stewart mentioned earlier, the Guardians, the Green Lantern Corps, has a treaty with Thanagar Prime. They are allies. So John says, well, you know, as much as I don't want to be at odds against the Green Lanterns, I'm not going to allow myself to be captured. And we also see Kendra Hawkgirl attack Shiera and Carter Hall, and they're basically trying to hold off these Green Lanterns, as well as the Vault Keepers and sort of the Hawk contingent here, so that John Jones can be free to go to the Martian Keep and find the answers that he needs. And even as he flees the fight and heads toward the Martian Keep again is imploring him, John, no, you must turn back. The weapon is too great. And John tells her, I can't. You know, I saw a vision when I neared the totality, and it scared him, basically. It's impossible memories of a childhood I never had, and with the source wall broken, you know, they called me an abomination, the Wall Guardians, and I have to know why. I need the answers. And the Martian Keep says, you don't understand what you're looking for. You know, you're digging up things that you shouldn't. But if you must see the dark deeds that Thanagar has done, then go ahead and come to me. And when he finds her, she has some strange looking crown on her head that has all these tentacles coming off of it. And he seems rather shocked by the appearance of her. And he says, my lady, what have they done to you? And the Martian Keep responds, it's called the Azorbascon. And it basically collects the knowledge and memories of the Thanagar race. And since their race has been one that's been around for a long time, and this is a really powerful artifact, it has become much more than that. It is the key to their survival and their place in the universe, because basically what happens is she's able to think whatever she wants to think, the Martian Keep does, and it becomes reality. So what started out as a kind of a different weapon an artifact with a different purpose to perhaps, you know, store the knowledge of a certain alien race, it has evolved beyond that. It can, instead of just being a repository for the memories of Thanagar, it can make those memories real. So she goes on to say, this is why they captured and imprisoned me, because they needed me to basically power this Absorbascon to make Thanagar Prime real. And she says, Katar Hall is a lie. The city above us is a lie. But if others knew how weak Thanagar had become, they would turn on it. So this illusion, in a way, is sort of necessary. And so without this artifact, without this Absorbascon, the Thanagarian people would be left to galactic irrelevance, and it would upset the balance of the universe. So John says, why is it so important, or what is so important, rather, that the Thanagarians would bring together the guardians of the universe, the dominators, all these other people? They would go to these lengths with the Absorbiscon. Like, what truth could they be so desperate to hide beyond the fact that their world was in ruins after the Rand Thanagar War? So, meanwhile, back in the fight between Carter and Shira Hall and Hawkgirl and John Stewart, Shira realizes that the Martian Manhunter's gone, and she wonders where he went. And the Thanagar, or the Martian Keep, is telling John Jones that one of the secrets that the Thanagarians are trying to keep is that this multiverse wasn't the first one. There was another multiverse before this, and its creator is coming back. And so back on Earth, we see that Wonder Woman has used her lasso to basically tie up and sort of ground, you want to put it in terms of electricity, ground Starman. And he thanks her for that. Not only is it grounding him and keeping his powers from spiraling out of control, but it's clearing his mind. And he says, you know, I'm sorry. I promise I wasn't here to hurt anybody. The fact that my power is actually, it's sourced from the totality. It connects me to every corner of the universe. And I can even see your friends now on Thanagar Prime. And I can see the broken source wall. And more than anything, I can feel her eyes. And Batman says, whose eyes? And Starman says, well, your friends just learned the story, and it hasn't been told in a billion years. And it's a story that could destroy the universe itself. It's the story of Perpetua, which we know that's the being that's encased in the totality. And who we know she's from that multiverse that came before this current multiverse of the DC universe. But was she just an inhabitant of that universe? Was she a ruler of that universe? What did she have to do? What was her role, if any, in the ending of that universe and the beginning of her own? I mean, there's a lot to be unpacked here, but we're barely scratching the surface. So this is a really fast-paced issue. I feel like last issue we got a lot more straight information on what's going on in the story, and I imagine issue 16 will be more like that as well. It'll be more of an information dump. This one feels a lot like a transitional issue. We do get a little bit of information, but it's more about moving the characters around in the story to put them where we need them to be. And we do get some hints that, yeah, things on Thanagar Prime are not good in terms of Shira and Carter Hall being open and honest with people. They're clearly doing things that they shouldn't, and they're supposed to be heroes. So seeing them do things that are not above board is a little bit strange in my eyes. So I'm not 100% sure I like that part of the story. I do think that the dialogue, the scripting James Tynan did is very good. And I think overall the story that Snyder and Tynan are crafting in these Justice League books is really strong as well. As far as the art goes, it's very classically Jim Chung art. And I don't know, I liked his art. This is going to sound really weird. I like his art so much more better. I like it so much better when he does Marvel. For some reason, I don't know why. When he does the DC stuff, I feel like it looks a little choppy. I'm not as big of a fan of his work on DC stuff as I am at Marvel. But it's still really great art. You know, Jim Chung is a great storyteller. The transitions from panel to panel are handled very well. And, you know, he also does get – some of these pages are clearly Segovia, but their art styles are similar enough that it doesn't necessarily pull you out of the story. The Segovia art tends to be a little cleaner. So I'm not even sure which one I like better, because there's things that I like. I like the fact that Segovia's art looks a little cleaner, but I like the feel and the storytelling of the Jim Chung art more than the Segovia art. So, yeah. I will say one thing, though, about the art, and that's the colors. The colors absolutely shine in this book from Tomeu Morey, who's, and Will Quintana. But Morey is really making a name for himself. Clay Mann's been singing his praises for his work on the the Heroes in Crisis series. So with right from the start with that big splash page of Starman with all the energy busting out of him to move into to Thanagar Prime and getting the flashbacks, Green Lantern showing up. The colors in this book are done very, very well. So like I said, Tynan and Snyder have been crafting a great story, and I feel like next issue is going to be a big one. What were your thoughts on this issue, Manny?
I thought this issue had a lot. I agree with you that it feels like that it's a transitional issue, but I mean it spent a lot of time kind of almost setting up like a Mission Impossible type scenario where John Stewart, Hawkgirl, and Martian Manhunter were going to have to figure out a way to infiltrate this this sacred vault where there's so many safeguards and booby traps and checkpoints. And you know, I was like, oh, is this going to be some type of Mission Impossible thing that they're gonna have to go through? And then like once they get in, like everything seems really, really, it like gets really fast paced. And all of a sudden Chiara shows up with her zombie Hawkman, and then the Green Lantern Corps shows up. And I was like, oh, I guess it's not that hard to get in. I understand where they're going with this, but it was a lot of information for an issue where we're still trying to get a whole lot more information about what's going on with the source wall, with the crack, and then the Starman back on Earth, and like you were talking about the other multiverse that existed before. And so, I mean, there's a lot going on. With that said, I did enjoy the issue. I still thought it was really entertaining. My favorite part of the issue is when the destroyers. No. What they're not. They're called destroyers. The
Dominators.
Destroyers. Yeah, the Dominators. They're just like, they're just really mad and upset and everything. And then all of a sudden, they're just. And then it's like, yeah, block. John Stewart's like, yeah, block the oxygen from reaching their brains. Instant nap time. I was like, oh, that was pretty quick and painless. That was pretty cool. And then the Hawkgirl chimes in and is like, yeah, I might ask you to try that on me sometime because I'm terrible at napping. That was a cool little light moment in a very, very serious situation. And so. It was still enjoyable. I like the almost like history lesson of how, you know, the vault Thanagar works. And like I said, I expected maybe then to a little bit more resistance getting in. But I understand also that it's a transitional issue and you know, we ain't got time for that. So it's okay. I do agree with you on the artwork. I don't know what it is about the art by Chung in this book that I love the first splash page. Don't get me wrong. And then there's another page where Martian Manhunter is like front and center. I mean, it looks really, really good, but I don't know. There's just something off about it. That's not what I entirely am accustomed to seeing from him. But I do also agree that the colors are really, really good. I love the way the colors work on all the costumes, and then the color transitions between Earth and Thanagar, just really, you know, different moods. And then when finally Martian Manhunter gets to the other Martian. Just the way that they put that, the white, the black, the kind of the gold on the head, on the headpiece, the shine. I thought that was done really, really beautifully. Really, really, really big, big story. So, good issue.
Yeah, what's interesting is I've given Tynan a lot of credit recently. You know, he was my writer of the year last year, so, you know, obviously I'm a big fan. I'm given a lot of credit on how great his scripting has been. And, you know, I realized saying that you're right, like little things like the nap moment. Yeah, I got a good chuckle out of that when Hawkgirl, as you said, oh, maybe you could try that on me, you know, removing all the oxygen so I can fall asleep. I have trouble taking naps sometimes. It's funny. It's a lighthearted moment. Like you said, it brings some lightheartedness to the story. But at the same time, I do feel like it's almost too much dialogue when we are getting all that information, like you said, about the way the vault works, because it just ends up feeling like this giant information dump. And it's just a lot of text boxes and they're not like small text boxes. And so I know for a lot of people that much writing can be intimidating, but you're right in that it does give it sort of that heist feel. Like all those text boxes that are explaining the way the vault works and all the safeguards and how hard it is to get into the vault and everything, that it's like the DC Comics / Justice League equivalent of like Ocean's 11 when George Clooney's character Danny Ocean is like explaining to everybody, okay, here's what the vault at the Bellagio looks like, here's all the safeguards, here's, you know, this and that and everything we have to get through. So you're right, in that way it does make this feel very much like a, you know, kind of like a heist story, a heist issue, where it's like, okay, you've got to deal with this and this and this, and once you deal with all this stuff, then, you know, maybe we'll be able to get into the vault and get the things that we need. So it's,
but you see what I mean though. But there's no payoff to it. They just quickly brush it off when they're like, hey, what's wrong with that kryptonite? It's like, oh, it's your.
which is a cool, you know, it's a cool way for them to get in. But you're right. It was right. Like, you almost think that if they made that big of a deal out of how hard it was to get into the vault, that they would have dedicated the rest of the issue to just them getting in. And maybe they didn't have the real estate when they planned it out to do that. You know, like maybe they thought originally they were going to have more room and the story was going to, you know, play out a little bit differently. And then when it came down to it, they realized, oh, wait, maybe we don't really have the room to spend all this time focusing on how they're getting into the vault. We've got to move the story along a little quicker. I mean, I'm just speculating, but it's not that it's a bad issue, but based on the way that it's laid out, it could have been something really, really cool if they would have had the time. I mean, just think about it, like a justice, like an Ocean's 11 type movie or event, but instead of having, you know, all those actors, you have the Justice Leaguers. Like, how cool would that be?
Right. Yeah. And that's what I mean. It's like I just invest so much time in about learning about all the ins and outs about this vault, and now everybody's in it a couple of panels later.
Yeah, so, I got to think that the as far as the Green Lantern Corps, I mean, I think those Green Lanterns must have come down with Shiera and Katar Hall.
I mean, and if it was such a big deal, they could have, like you said, sucked the air out of the room. I don't know. They're just a couple of potholes that you gave me too much information, and now I want more answers.
You made it sound too hard to get there, and then in the long run, you made it look easy for them to get there.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I agree with you to some extent. But like we both said, it is an enjoyable issue, so We'll give Tynan and Snyder a pass this time. But what about overall? What about the story of this totality story, Justice League overall? I mean, it's even though we've had these smaller arcs, like we had the first arc that was very focused on the totality. We get these Legion of Doom interludes every once in a while. We had the Drowned Earth storyline. And now we're doing this Thanagar Prime storyline. How have you felt about the title overall? Is Justice League living up to the hype? Because Snyder, you know, last year he really hyped the heck out of it. He talked about it at WonderCon. He talked about it at Phoenix Comic Con and talked about it at San Diego Comic Con. It was like all he talked about the first part of last year. Every show he did, it was like Justice League, Justice League, Justice League. So do you feel like it's lived up to the billing that he gave it?
Well, so far it has. Just because they've done a really good job at spreading out the story across the universe. I mean, you have it. You can tell it's affecting everyone, from everyone on Earth. I know that probably the Drowned Earth part has a little bit to do with the fact that they wanted to tie in Aquaman during that time for the movie, but it worked. And then also, I mean, I have this kind of new Thanagard. You have the Green Lanterns involved. I mean, Starman's with over or back on Earth. So you can kind of see the pieces coming together as far as this is a really, really big deal. And the longer the Justice League runs, the bigger the stage seems to be being set to give us, you know, what Roy would hope is going to be a huge payoff, something that's going to affect just massive amounts of characters and planets. And I mean, just even at the end of this issue, we see that, you know, they start talking about the universe that existed before. And then finally, you have Starman saying the story of Perpetua. So it's like, all right, what's that? And why is it so important that it's going to affect this entire landscape? So it really did for me, like, you know, he's setting it up. I think it's done a really good job, but now it's a matter of how they deliver that, those climatic moments. So I mean, so far, you know, it lives up to the hype. I think it's just maybe it requires a little bit more patience than previously anticipated, but I think it's great.
Well, the other thing I wonder about, is it going too slowly?
That's what I'm saying, is that I get it, because I love information dumps. I love knowing more. But like issue like this, if you take out a lot of that information about the vault, about how hard it is to get in, doesn't necessarily change the issue, but now it makes it easier to read.
Yeah, but what's funny is we're talking about, okay, they didn't have the real estate, they didn't have the space to slow down even more and give us a whole issue of them just breaking into the vault. So can we make that complaint about, yeah, it would have been cool to see that, because that would have slowed the story down even more. So we complain about that, and then we say, but overall, the entire totality story, the broken source wall, what happened with Dark Knight's Metal and No Justice, it's going too slow. Like, we can't, you know,
I mean, like, for like you and I, who, I mean, we reread tons of comics weekly. It's great. I cannot, reading this, something I think about, this is not a book I can recommend to somebody who's just getting into comics. I think it would be very, very difficult to understand and to grasp the entire enormity of the event.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, you're, I mean, this is definitely a title that's for like hardcore DC fans.
But the team you have writing it, they're superstar team that already has a huge following anyway. So I get it. It works. But like, if somebody's like, hey, should I read Justice League? I've never really picked up a comic book. Whatever. Is that what you recommend? My answer? Absolutely not.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe you do. I mean, it is well done. It's a good story. It's well crafted. It's good comics.
This is nothing against, this is a great book. There's nothing against that. It's just, it might, for a new reader, it might be a little too much. Too quick. Whoa, that's a lot to take in.
I get what you're saying, but at the same time, like when I started reading comics, that's how it was. It was like you just kind of dove in and you just had to figure it out as you went along. There wasn't, I feel like now we sort of coddle people a little bit in a way. We're like, okay, yeah, it's got to be new reader friendly and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I know back then, you know, we've talked about it in some of our recap stuff where we look at some, you know, cover some books that are from different eras, and they always have those, you know, 4, 5, 6 panels where it recaps everything that happened in, you know, the last issue or so. You know, we've been on the Marvel chronology. We see that quite a bit. And so in that way, I guess it comics from way back when did have a little bit of a leg up when it came to helping out new readers as opposed to these. But at the same time, I feel like, man, if you're interested enough to pick up Justice League and you want to know more about it, there's this thing called the internet and Google, and you can, like, all the information that you need to know about the DC universe, DC characters, you know, past events and history, it's all there if you want to go and find it. So it's all a matter of how much investment you want to put into the story.
Well, I mean, Justice League requires a ton of investment. I mean, you have to, just this issue alone, it touches on Martian Manhunter's backstory and his history. And, you know, you have to understand, you know, who the Green Lanterns are and what are they doing, Thanagard. And, you know, because what's the deal with Hawkman and why is that important? And, you know, even just a little bit of the, some of the Dominators, you know, who, you know, what kind of role do they play in it? And then you throw a curveball, also a character like Starman. I mean, it's a lot, which is great, like for us, because I mean, we've seen a lot of these entities and characters in different places, and now they're all mixed together in one huge story. But if for someone to get going, I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Also, that it can be like this giant gateway to get you to read, you know, this story arc here and that story arc over there, and you pick up this title over here. But man, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, but I do feel like if you pick up this Justice League run and you read it from the beginning, and I don't know, maybe I'm so far out of touch. I've read so many comics. I know the DC universe so well at this point. It's hard for me to put myself in somebody's, you know, like a new reader's shoes. Somebody that doesn't have a lot of knowledge, it's hard for me to kind of relate and see it the way they see it, because again, I'm so far removed from that after years and years of reading. I don't know that I could, you know, I can really relate to that. So, but yeah, I think overall this is a good story. It's steeped very well in the history and the lore of the DC universe. And I think Scott talked about that when, you know, when he first was, as I mentioned, talking about it at every show he was going to, he talked about the fact that this was really kind of his way of giving back to longtime DC fans and readers, because there's so much here, as you said, you know, there's so much depth, and you're seeing characters that maybe we haven't seen in the DC universe for a long time. And he's pulling together a lot of DC lore and DC stories from, you know, years past, and it makes for a really great and cool story. So I think overall it's been pretty good, but I do wonder if some people think that it's moving too slowly. That would be my one, I don't even want to say complaint, but I just wonder if people think that it's moving too slow. I will say that I've never read a Justice League story or know of a Justice League title, or can think of an era of the Justice League that was more tied in to the DC universe than this. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I get that.
This version of this Justice League title, this version of the Justice League is more central to what's going on in the DC universe than any previous iteration of the Justice League than I can think of. So there is that to think about. So, all right, well, let's move on. I think we've talked Justice League to death here. What do we want to talk about next? Let's talk about Captain Marvel number one. Let me give the creative team really quickly here. It's from writer Kelly Thompson. We have art by Carmen Canero. Colors are by Tamara Bonbillon. Letters by Clayton Cowles. And so basically this series picks up right where the Life of Captain Marvel miniseries ends. Did you read that Life of Captain Marvel miniseries?
No, I didn't.
So in that Captain Marvel, Life of Captain Marvel miniseries, we did get some information that we hadn't previously known about Captain Marvel. And that was that her mother was actually a Kree. She was a Kree warrior that was sent to be a spy on Earth and ended up falling in love with Carol Danvers' father, married him, sort of abandoned her mission as this Kree spy. And so when the previous origin of Carol Danvers, which was, you know, she was caught in this explosion when the original Captain Marvel was battling some supervillain, and when this piece of Kree equipment exploded, it somehow fused some of Captain Marvel, the male original Captain Marvel, it fused some of his DNA to Carol Danvers' DNA, and that's what gave her superpowers. With this revelation that she had that Kree DNA all along, they've sort of tweaked the origin a little bit. And now what we're to understand is that explosion that she was caught in basically triggered her latent Kree genetic heritage already. So I like the change. I have a feeling that the reason they made the change was for the movie. It's probably going to be the way she gets her powers in the movie. So I don't know. Maybe they thought it made more sense that way as opposed to the old sort of Silver Age way that she got her powers. I don't know. So it didn't. I like that they didn't completely rewrite her origin, and this kind of was additive in a way. And so I'm okay with it. You know, a lot of times when they change things just for the sake of changing them or for the movie, it kind of bugs me, but I was okay with this. So after spending all the time with her family, growing closer to her mother than she ever had been, discovering her true heritage and such, with Captain Marvel issue one, she's ready to sort of come out of her hiatus and become a member of the Avengers again, become a more active superhero again. And we see in this issue that she fights some giant Kraken / octopus sea monster kind of thing with her one of her best friends, Jessica Drew, or Spider-Woman. We see her meet with Tony Stark, and he kind of explains to her that because of the role that she had most recently running Alpha Flight and being out in space, now that she's back on Earth and she's going to be an active member of the Avengers again, she's going to need to do some interviews, do some press, basically, because times have changed a little bit since she was last a member of the Avengers. And basically, people don't know her and people don't trust her because she's been out in space. And when people hear the term space, it doesn't seem, it's something that's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And so she doesn't necessarily have the same kind of street cred that she maybe deserves as a hero. And so she's not real happy about that, but she agrees. She knows it's for the greater good. And then Tony asks for another favor on top of that, which is he wants Carol to mentor Hazmat, who apparently – I had never heard of the character before, but apparently she was part of the Young Avengers or Avengers Academy at one point, and her powers have to do with her radiating this radiation that can be very harmful to other humans. And she was able to learn to control it at the Avengers Academy and prevent her from basically giving other people cancer or making them sick from radiation poisoning. But all of a sudden, her powers seem to be growing She seems to becoming more powerful, and she's having a hard time controlling those powers again. So she sought out the help of Tony Stark, because if anybody knows anything about suits, containment suits and armor containment and all that, it's Tony Stark. But Tony's having a hard time relating to her and getting through to her. So he asks Carol if she'll step in. And no sooner does she agree than she runs into her old love interest, Rhodey, James Rhodes. They were going pretty hot and heavy there for a while. And then Civil War II happened, and Rhodey got killed. And Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, even tells Rhodey when she clearly hasn't taken the time to sort of reconnect with him. And she mentions that a couple of things. She mentions when she sees him that she felt like it was the universe telling them they weren't meant to be together, because they got in this relationship, and no sooner than they did than Rhodey was killed. And also, she didn't know what to say. She's like, I don't know what to say. It feels like it was so final, and it almost, losing you almost broke me. And I if I were to lose you again, I don't know, you know, how that would feel. And so, although it seems awkward, Rhodey takes it exactly the opposite way as Carol. He says, well, I took it completely the other way. I took it like, man, now I've got this second chance because I'm alive again. And I really would like to, you know, to spend some time together. And so they agree to go out for a bite. And no sooner do they do that than they're attacked by the Nuclear Man, who at the end of the issue grabs this reporter that Carol was supposed to be doing the interview with, and leaves through some sort of trans-dimensional portal. And so Carol is able to follow Nuclear Man through that portal, and the rest of the Avengers are left behind. And then we get this splash page on the back that, or the final page, that makes it seem like maybe Carol's going to be in this alternate world for a little while. Because, I mean, long enough that her costume has changed, her haircut has changed, and this guy, this Nuclear Man from this other dimension, he's pretty misogynist. He's kind of a jerk, honestly. And if he's the ruler of that dimension, you could only imagine that Carol's not going to just go to that dimension, rescue this reporter, and then come back to our reality or our world or our universe or our dimension, whatever you want to call it, and leave whoever the females are that reside in that universe to suffer the misogynistic rule of this this Nuclear Man guy. So, fun story. I will say that it's not. I didn't enjoy it as much as the Kelly Sue DeConnick stuff or the Margaret Soul stuff, because I really do feel like you're hit over the head with the feminist part. And don't get me wrong, I consider myself a feminist, and I'm all for like equal male, female superheroes, whatever. But it was a really heavy-handed in this issue, and in my mind, the best kind of stories that do that are when everybody's treated equally, but it's not even commented on because that's just the way that it should be. You know what I'm saying? I understand that some people like to have it a little more obvious. They feel like it makes more of an impact that way, and that's fine. You know, again, different strokes for different folks. But I don't know, just the tone and the mood and the feel of this Captain Marvel series, it didn't grab me. So I don't know if I'm going to come back for more. I may try out one more issue just to see. You know, I always say you shouldn't just read one issue. You always got to give it at least two or three. So I'll probably read one more issue, because I am curious to see if my prediction about her being in this other dimension for an extended period of time and starting some sort of rebellion. I want to see if I'm right in that guess, if you will. But yeah, I don't know how long I'll stick around for this one. And the other thing was, the art's not bad, the art by Carmen Caniero, but similarly to the mood and the tone of the story, the art doesn't really do much for me. It's just not my style. It's a little bit, a little bit rough for my taste. I think the storytelling is fine. But yeah, the the art, and it's colored really well. Like the color palette and the brightness of the colors, or I should say the lack of brightness of the colors, the kind of the muted palette that Tamara Bonvillain uses really suits this art style. But it's, again, it's not like my kind of art style. And to me, it's not a superhero kind of art style. This art style would be better suited like a crime noir or something besides superheroes. Like, I think this style of art would be really good on something like Postal. But for superhero art, I feel like it needs to be what I like in my superhero art is a little bit cleaner lines. And what goes hand in hand with that is brighter colors. So I don't think bright colors would work on this art. It would look really bad. It would just look bad. It would look really muddy if you tried to use bright colors on this sort of art. So I think the color choices that Tamara makes are the right ones. But again, it's not my style of art. So one more issue. I'll probably give my thoughts on that, and then we'll see where it goes from there. But the last thing I'll say about Captain Marvel is I am really excited to go check out that movie. It looks amazing. I only saw the first trailer because I didn't want it to be spoiled, but because it seems like they're dropping new trailers every other week now. But now that the media embargo has been lifted, I've been hearing nothing but good things. And I know Rotten Tomatoes changed the way that they allow reviews to be put on their site, thanks to a bunch of idiots that were giving Captain Marvel bad reviews, which is just insanely stupid. You don't have anything better to do with your time. And it's just ridiculous that people are like, oh, female superhero, I have to give it a negative review, even though I haven't seen it. Idiotic, completely. So anyway, what were your thoughts on this issue, Manny?
Well, based on how it ended, I know it's going to sound a little harsh, but I felt like most of the issue was a waste of time. Just because I could have done with the issue beginning with Carol with the pretty much the last fight. Just with Nuclear Man and that fight, and then going into that other dimension. If that's the path they're gonna take. Because you're right, at the last panel we see, it says revolutionary. And then you see their kind of Mad Max style almost costumes that they have on. And so yeah, I'm guessing most of this book is going to take place in a different dimension, which is way different than what we see on the cover and where the book kicks off. I mean, it kind of sets her up like he's going to have to be dealing with a lot of pressure from just being a new member of the Avengers in this day and age and the society that they're living in, and just kind of getting back to that. And so I didn't mind the first big monster battle. That's the classic way to start a book. And then it was fine up until Rhodey shows up, and it just deviates, and then all of a sudden they're just having dinner and they're flirting and stuff, and I'm like, oh, all right, this kind of is this gonna go somewhere? Is this, you know, I get it, they dated, like these entire panels could be used for something else. And I don't know, it took me out of the story completely. And then they try to bring really back in with the reporter, and it just by that point I was no longer interested anymore. And then it goes to Nuclear Man, and she's gone. She's in another dimension, and the other Avengers couldn't make it in. So now she's pretty much on her own, which is fine. I get that. You need that answer that question. Where's the rest of the Avengers? But now kind of, I spent this entire first issue selling her into this world, and next issue and probably the next couple of issues have nothing to do with it. So I felt kind of cheated in a way. It was kind of a waste of time to get through this issue and then to find out that no, it's going to be something completely different the next issue. But like you said, I kind of want to see where it goes next issue. I'm still will be picking up the next one just to see what direction it goes and if it doesn't change again or what's the deal. It's just kind of strange that with Captain Marvel, you know, the film coming out very soon, that this is the kind of direction that you want to take on the story. But, you know, it's whatever, it's Marvel.
Yeah, so interesting. I you're right about the Mad Max thing, like completely, especially the most recent Mad Max, because didn't they have some female characters that were like kicking butt or whatever? So the Furies, were they called or something like that?
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
Furiosa.
Yeah, Furiosa, there you go. So yeah, I get that, 100%. That's definitely the vibe. So it's kind of interesting. You know, you said the rest of the issue is kind of a waste of time. And I agree with you, but something occurred to me while you were talking. So maybe the reason Kelly Thompson put all that other stuff in there, like, okay, Carol, you're finally back on Earth. You're rejoining the Avengers. So, you need to put your best face forward. You need to or best foot forward, rather. You need to do these interviews. And, you know, Tony's asking for her help in helping train this other young hero and, you know, reconnect with Rhodey and have a great conversation at dinner and everything. Maybe Thompson did all that so that she could then flip Captain Marvel into this other dimension. And it's like, okay, as soon as she got back to Earth, now she's pulled off in another direction. Because you do get sort of this this feel and tone. It's mentioned in the book when Hazmat is complaining about, or not necessarily complaining, but just talking about her powers, how they have this negative side effect to them. And Carol talks about how kind of her powers have brought her bad luck in a way. And, you know, she had her powers stolen by Rogue. Then she was changed into Binary. And then she eventually got original powers back. So she went from being Miss Marvel to Binary back to Miss Marvel. And now she's Captain Marvel. And so it's a little bit of that whole roller coaster ride. And again, Carol's not complaining. But, when you look at her, the history of her character, you could chalk it up as like, man, you know, she doesn't get any breaks. She's always getting things are always going badly for her. They're always going, hey, almost like Spider-Man, right? Like nothing can ever go right. And so it's, and again, I have no idea if this is the case because we don't know how long she's going to be in this other dimension. Maybe it's just an issue. Maybe it's just two issues and she's going to come back. In that case, I don't know that it's that big of a deal. But if Kelly Thompson leaves her over there for like six or eight issues, then you definitely feel like, well, what was the point of the first three quarters of issue one? Well, maybe it was because when Captain Marvel comes back from this other dimension, she's like, now I have to do this all over again. You know, Stark's going to be like, where did you go? Hazmat needs your help. Maybe by that time, Rhodey's dating somebody else. I mean, we don't know. Because the other thing I thought when I saw this page, this, you know, Mad Max style page for the final issue and, you know, Revolutionary, is we don't know that time passes the same in these different dimensions, right? Like she could be over there. Captain Marvel could be over there for what feels like a year to her. And she comes back and it's only been 5 minutes in our dimension. You know, just like we saw recently in the Uncanny X-Men Disassembled storyline, when some of the younger X-Men got pulled into the Age of Apocalypse and they were there for over a year. And when Bishop finally goes in there to help rescue them, they're like, oh my God, what took you so long? And he's like, dudes, it's been 5 minutes. Calm down. So, yeah, we don't know. And I guess based on that, it's probably worth picking up one more issue at least of this. But what do you think of the art? You didn't mention anything one way or the other.
You know, I like the art. You know, the kind of what your complaints about it is something I really, really liked about it. I love the facial features that they do for her. I love the facial feature when the monster, the Kraken eats the little girl, like that, her just like, you can just see her snap from kind of like, let's defeat this monster to like she says, oh, hell no.
Yeah. Oh, hell and no. Yep.
So that was really good. And then, you know, I know I complained about then just her, when she's interacting with Tony Stark, facial features, I thought they were done really well. Same thing when she's going out with Rhodey, when she's kind of putting her hair back behind her ear. That panel was done really, really well. I know I was complaining about those scenes, but the artwork's done well. I'm just saying they're just not placed correctly. I think there's a time and place for it. I don't think now is the time and place. Because like you're mentioning the costumes for the and the last page, if you're going to radically change your costume like that, I don't think you just make that decision the next day. I think you've gone through some stuff and you've modified it to fit this world better, because you're in it for fight for a while. So I'm going to assume that they're going to be there for a while. So, but it will be, and if not, if she's maybe jumping back and forth, she figures out a way to do that. I don't know. Well, that's why I guess you and I got to read the next issue to find out what happens. That's kind of the whole point. But I guess, this issue, depending on what happens going forward, I'll get a better judgment of like, all right, that makes more sense now. But for as of right now, I just really feel like you could have just started with Nuclear Man and gone into this world, and I don't feel like at this moment I've missed too much, because I mean, if she's been away for that long, then she still misses things anyway. Like I didn't need to be reminded of the certain things that she has here, because she was still kind of uncomfortable with Tony, and interview this and do this and do that, and then all of a sudden she's going to be thrown into a mentor role, and she's been thrown back into not a relationship, but just an ex-lover, and then it's almost like, and in a way I almost feel like, hey, maybe, thinking about it now, is like maybe this is an escape for her. She goes to this world and it's like, oh, it's a, I kind of got to escape from that, all of those responsibilities that all of a sudden I had again, and she's made, I don't know, now I'm just thinking out loud.
I don't know, my money's on the time's going to pass faster in that world than in ours. So she's going to feel like she was.
I think so.
She was there for a long time, like a year or 2 years, and helped,
Yeah, kind of like when also in DC when Batman and Wonder Woman gave what's his face a break.
Yep.
So, yeah. I mean,
that's
what. But artwork. I liked it. I really liked it. I liked that last panel that you were talking about. And then the cover, it's Amanda Connor, and you cannot like her artwork, so nothing you can do. And like I said, just her the way that Carmen does the faces, I thought was really, really well done. So in that aspect, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that her facial features is by far the strength of her art. I would completely agree with you. I noticed that. I didn't mention it when I was talking about it, so I'm glad you did. Because, yeah, I did notice when I was reading it for the first time that the facial features are done really, really well. And the other thing that we didn't really mention is kind of the scripting. As we said, it's Kelly Thompson, who I know she's a good writer. She worked on that Uncanny X-Men Disassembled storyline I was just talking about a little while ago. And I know that she's a big fan of Captain Marvel, so this is sort of a dream come true project for her. And she does have little moments in this story that are funny. She puts in some little moments that kind of make you laugh. And I think it's cool. Like the Oh Hell No panel, or once Captain Marvel has basically gone inside this Kraken to rescue this little girl before she can be eaten, and then busts out of the Kraken and comes out with like all this pink blood all over her. And she's literally wiping off her face, and Jessica turns to her and goes, you got something right there. I just thought that was great. Obviously, she has
something. Like the moment that I like is actually right after when they're talking about Tony Stark. And then all of a sudden, all the bots appear, and he's like, like Beetlejuice. Yeah. Or maybe I'm thinking of Babadook. And he's like, oh, whichever is more annoying. So, oh, okay, Beetlejuice.
Yeah, then. Beetlejuice.
And then they ask him, he's like, hey, are you really there? He's like, yeah, of course I'm here. And then they both look at each other and go, remote pilot. Yeah. I thought that was good.
100%. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, as we said, it was a good start. I'm not sure about all the kind of the feminist angle, if it's for me. So I guess, you know, I guess we'll wait and see. But I think we're both in for at least one more issue to see. I'm curious. I just want to know kind of how that whole revolutionary thing goes down. Like, is she starting a revolution, you know, an uprising against Nuclear Man? Does time pass differently? I'm very curious about that.
Right.
So I guess I'm in for one more as it pertains to that. All right, now onto the last book we're going to talk about. It's The Wrong Earth. It's written by Tom Pyre, art by Jamal Igel, inks by Juan Castro, letters by Andy Troy, and letters by Rob Steen. There's also a backup feature called Stinger from writer Paul Constant, art, color, and letters by Frank Camuso. Then there are a couple of Q&As, one with Jamal Igel, one with Stuart Moore. And then we have a text story from Grant Morrison with some illustrations by Rob Steen that's called HUD, Hornet's Holiday in Hell. And then there is a one-page cartoon by Too Much Coffee Man. So, as I said, this title's getting a lot of buzz. It's really interesting. It stars a hero called Dragonfly Man. And there's basically, there's Earth Alpha and there's Earth Omega. And you could think of Earth Alpha as sort of the Silver Age world, where everything is sort of lighthearted and there's not a lot of blood and guts and gore, and the superheroes are all on good terms with the police, and the supervillains don't really kill anybody. They're just out to, you know, sort of rob banks and do art heists and things like that. And it's just a much more innocent overall world, right? Even the villains are not that bad, you'd say. You know, teenage sidekicks and all that kind of stuff. Just think like classic DC Silver Age, where nothing is grim dark or dark and gritty. As opposed to Earth Omega, which is sort of the exact opposite of that. It is the dark, it is the grim dark, it is the dark gritty. It is even a superhero like, he's not Dragonfly Man there. He's just Dragonfly. You know, he's like the Punisher or Batman if he was willing to kill. So if somebody crosses the line in self-defense, he's willing to kill. He's willing to, you know, burn somebody alive or beat them with a baseball bat or whatever he needs to do, right? As long as he's serving the cause of justice, so to speak. And so there's these two versions, you know, same character, but like basically two different iterations of him. Say the 1986 Dark Knight Returns version and the 1966 Silver Age version. And so in the middle of the story, this villain who's known as, is it called 01, I think is his name.
O-1,
yeah. He goes to he can travel through mirrors, apparently, kind of like Mirror Master. And he goes through a mirror and he comes out the other side, and he has not only traveled through the mirror, but he's traveled through dimensions. So this villain, number one, the Silver Age version, ends up, he goes from being on Earth Alpha to being on Earth Omega. And the number one from Earth Omega ends up on Earth Alpha. So all of a sudden you've introduced this terrible villain into this more naive superhero Silver Age world. And you've introduced this, more naive villain to this grim, dark world. But not only have you switched number one, these two villains, but also Dragonfly and Dragonfly Man, respectively, they chase after by running through the mirror. They chase after number one and they end up switching. So you end up with this somewhat naive Silver Age version of this hero in this grim dark world, and you end up with this grim dark version of a hero in the Silver Age world, where the police show up to, you know, arrest the criminals. And he's surprised that they're like congratulating him and saying, oh, you know, it's great that you heroes are on our side and we have so much respect for you. And, you know, it's great that you're here. You're a noble crime fighter. We pray you never take the granted perils you face on behalf of the city. And they tell him, and his sidekick is still alive, and like, you know, everything is sort of rose-colored glasses. As opposed to the other side, where the Silver Age Dragonfly man from Earth Alpha, when he goes to Earth Omega and tries to ask for help from the police, he gets shot by the police. They unmask him, find out who he is, and then try to bribe him and get money out of him, because they recognize him and realize he's this rich, Wall Street guy. Yeah. And so they say, yeah, we're going to get you your medical attention, okay? Then you're going to get us what we need, money. And that's how the issue ends. So it's a super interesting concept. As I said, it was very well received, critically acclaimed. I heard a lot of good things about it. I kind of thought we'd get a little bit more in the first issue in terms of them kind of realizing that they've switched. But I mean, it's only the last couple of pages that they even switch. And they start to have an idea that they're not in Kansas anymore. So I think we're up to issue four or five. So I'm really curious. I'm going to have to go and pick up the rest of the issues and get caught up. But it is an interesting concept. It's Jamal Igel art. So it's traditional superhero art. I'll especially call out the color work, because the color work is done really, really well by Andy Troy, because it is two separate palettes, right? Like the Earth Omega, which is the Silver Age Earth, is obviously much more bright and cheery, whereas Earth Omega is the grim dark world, and so obviously it's a little darker. The palette is darker, and it seems like it's like perpetually night there, and it's as you would expect. So I thought it was great. I understand what the buzz is all about. I'm definitely going to have to get caught up on this title. And I don't know if you can still get, I think issue one sold out. I don't know if they did reprints. I don't know if you can find it, but I know it's available digitally. So yeah, I thought it was great. What were your thoughts, Manny?
So when we were going to do this issue, this is what I love about comic books sometimes is I hadn't heard anything about this book. I hadn't heard anything about Hoy Comics or nothing. So when you sent me this book over so that we could review it, spotlight it, I didn't know anything. I just started reading it. And so sometimes I find myself so pleasantly surprised with what I get. And that's one thing I really love about reading comics, is that you get that. So, for example, this book, I just picked it up, opened it up, started reading it, and then immediately you have these two heroes in a situation. So like, all right, what's going on? And then it kind of draws you in, and then this weird villain number one, and is really just kind of, like you said, Silver Age. And it's like, all right. And then like, as soon as like I felt like I was really getting into it, it was like, bam, when it goes into more of a modern feel, and just dark and gritty. And I was like, wait, this is the same hero. What's going on? And then, the mirror happens where they switch off. And I was like, whoa, this is different. And this is kind of cool. So, I really, really liked it. And then, I mean, just the distinct differences, even from the villains, it was so good. And then the differences in the police officers, and then the, like you were talking about the colors. I mean, just so distinct and just so different. And, so I really, really enjoyed this. So this is one I could definitely recommend it to people. I thought it was really well done. It was really, really simple too, which I really liked. I know you're talking, I think that it was just long enough, because now it has me hooked, because now I want to see how they, when do they figure out, that who's who, and, and how do they deal with that? And is the sidekick okay? And how are they going to deal with these police officers? And there's, I have so many questions that I want answered, so I want to keep reading this. So as far as length, for a first issue, it does a really good job of hooking you. And I can see why the book is getting praise.
I didn't read any of the back matter. Did you read any of that?
I took a little bit look at the Stinger backstory. It has that really. I'm not sure if it's just old or if it's that they reprinted it or if it's actually.
No, this is all new material. So I think they were purposefully trying to make it look like it was an old
comic. Oh, okay. I kind of glanced through it, but. At that point, that is not necessarily my cup of tea. So, I just kind of looked through it, but I was just so enthralled with the main story that's really where I wanted it to stay.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Really good though.
Yeah. So we're definitely gonna have to check out some of the subsequent issues and give you our thoughts on them. So. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Anything else you want to say about any of these titles, Manny?
Not really. Not much that we haven't already covered.
Yeah. Again, Captain Marvel number one. Probably going to give it a second issue a chance, just to kind of see. Again, the first issue, it was a little dichotomous. You know, it started off one way and then completely. Like switched gears, and Manny and I are both curious to see, okay, which gear are you going? Like which path are you taking? So that was sort of the verdict on that one. Wrong Earth number one, we're both in. Absolutely incredible, really fun concept. Curious to see where it goes from there. And then Justice League, we're a lot further down the path. Again, it's very dense. Probably a book that's intended for longtime DC fans. Not necessarily. I won't say it's not new reader friendly, but there is a. You have to be willing to invest some time if you're going to get into the story of the totality and just how much that Justice League book ties in not only to the overall DC universe of modern day of current day, but also how much how many hooks and things it has going back to the past and. The history of DC Universe and legacy characters and just mining from the decades and decades of history and story and lore that the DC Universe is known for. So that's kind of where we shake out on these three books. Just a reminder, this episode has been brought to you by Aftershock Comics, the 2017 Diamond New Publisher of the Year. Be sure to go to aftershockcomics.com to check out creator lineups, series synopses, and the diamond codes for all their books, so you can pre-order them from your retailer. Coming up this next Wednesday, March 6th, we have a couple titles dropping from Aftershock, including the second issue of Oberon from Ryan Parrott and Miloš Slavkovic, as well as the eighth issue of the critically acclaimed A Walk Through Hell, written by Garth Ennis with art by Goran Suzuka. Both really, really great titles that I recommend. So take up Aftershock on their challenge to make 2019 the year of reading dangerously. And the last thing I want to mention about Aftershock, I'll be talking about this more in detail on an upcoming episode of the Comic Source for Aftershock Monday, but they do have a program coming up called Agents of Change, where they're going to be recruiting some Aftershock fans to help be ambassadors for the publisher. So as I said, stay tuned to Aftershock Mondays for more information about that. So as always, thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network. So when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.